Oh, such a good question.
Well, when you come up with these questions, that's another great branding question.
That's a big question.
That's a very interesting question because it really makes you think about what you just did.
Welcome to the Your Living Brand Live Show. This show is all about how you communicate your value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Through our weekly conversations with our guests, we will explore different ways to enable you to demonstrate your uniqueness while we ask them, what's your story? And now, welcome our host, Ben Baker.
And welcome back to the Your Living Brand Got Live show. This is Ben Baker. It is a gorgeous day and another wonderful week. And I want to thank everybody for being part of this show. It is amazing to me week after week, month after month, year after year, the wonderful comments that I get from people, the generosity, you know, the comments, the shares, everything that I get from people, because it's all about my guests. It's never about me. It's about my guests because I want to tell their story. I want to help everybody in my audience get better. That's what it's all about. It's about elevating. It's about sitting there going, you know what? I never thought about that, but you know what? I can do that too. And I think that that's what this show should be about and the conversation be about. It's not about us. It's about how can we help others. And with that, I've got an amazing guest this week. Corey Warfield has a company called Shed Wool. And we got to start this all over again because I've got to bugger that.
No, Ben, let's leave it. And here's why. I've got a partner of mine that I love to death here in Chicago. We do things together. He's a channel partner of Shed Wool. He and I have shared stages together. I love him. I wasn't going to use too many names, but I'll call Dr. Marius Danchia out by name. He always calls it Sherwood also. So there's something there. And so we're going to take that. We're going to run with it. And it gives me an amazing opportunity to simply say hi. I don't want to cut you off and steal the show, but my name's Corey Warfield. I started a company 4 years ago called Shed Wool, and that's a play on the word schedule. It's about a third of the English speaking world pronounces the word Shed Wool, and it's spelled so funny that I have a scheduling company called Shed Wool. And for the purposes of this show, we can call it anything other than late for supper.
People call me all sorts of things, and I keep telling people the same thing. You know what? As long as you feed me, I'm good with it. So, Corey, welcome to the show. I haven't done that in a long time, bugger somebody's name or their company name up. So thank you for being so generous. But let's get into this because you have an incredible story. You know, there's a lot of people that say, oh, I came from nothing. But you know what? 20 years ago, you did. You came from absolutely nothing. And you were able to sit there and say, you know what? I'm not going to sit there and grab my knees. I'm not going to sit there and rock back and forth. I'm going to find a way to move forward. So I'm going to let you tell the story of where did you come from, where you are today, and then we'll go from there. Because it's a great story and people need to know this.
Sure. Well, thank you. And I guess I'll back up a little bit even before that, because I assume what you're talking about is when I was living on the streets for about a year. But prior to that, I grew up in Evanston, great family, AP student in high school, went to college on a full academic scholarship. College was not for me, but at 19, when I dropped out, I came back to Chicago. I was a computer software tester back in 1997, working on the first Atlas and GPS software in the world with Rand McNally. I left there to become a metrologist, which is the science of weights and measures. For sterile pharmaceutical research. We made a number of pharmaceuticals, but our big product then, and I believe they still are, the manufacturers of NutraSweet. So they came up with the formulation of the artificial sweetener. I was making $20 an hour at the time at 19 as a college dropout in the 90s, which was a fair amount of money. And so a year or two after that, when I had literally lost my mind, didn't want to be alive anymore, I'd gone through some family stuff, some psychological problems, I did find myself on the streets for about a year. And so everyone has their own reality. For me, it was interesting. I was sometimes living in and out of motels. I would have beautiful girlfriends that would let me live in their garages and things like that. I was so young at the time, I was 20 years old. So it's people my age didn't have their own places, and I was no longer in the Chicagoland area, so I didn't know anybody, and I wasn't very welcome. And at the time, we would eat out of garbage cans sometimes. And yeah, I had friends that were also on the street, so they knew what to do. They knew you go to the grocery stores, and the food that they had to throw out at the end of the day was in bags that were tied up. So again, I wasn't wrestling food out of raccoons' hands or anything like that. But for about a year, no job, no place to live, no mailing address. This is back in the late 90s, so no cell phone, right? The internet was still very new. And believe it or not, what I was trying to do for a living back then was I was trying to be a rap star. So I would go to these open mics, up and down the West Coast, and I'd perform, and sometimes I would make a little bit of money, and then 2 days later I'd be broke for the rest of the week and beg for money to eat and stuff like that. But ultimately, after about a year, I had a girl, and she wanted to take me on a homeless vacation. She was also somewhat homeless, but she had a brother that was in Colorado, and she also had a court date. And so she found some people that were driving kind of that way that had two seats in their car, and so she and I kind of hitchhiked to Colorado, to a little mountain town and from the West Coast. And so she brought me out there, and it was beautiful, and I was in this tiny, very wealthy town, and I just felt this sense of belonging. And I found a guy that was living in a garage, and he was renting the garage for, I think, $100 a month from a lady that owned the house. And the garage door didn't work, and she didn't own a car, and the thing was falling down. And, you know, obviously there's no running water in a garage. But so he basically said, you can stay with me for a month, and if you want to stay longer than that, you can split the rent with me. And I think anybody listening would understand that $50 a month is a doable rent, but not without a job. So I went out and found a job, and I started washing dishes at a pizza place there in this small town. And for whatever reason, I think I was the only guy in town that couldn't afford a snow or ski board or ski. And so I was available 7 days a week, and I didn't need to sleep in, and I wasn't up on the hill. So I worked 7 days a week. I didn't have running water or a bathroom in the garage. And so I chose to be where there was warmth and running water and things like that. So I show up every day early for my shift, stay late. I was the best worker they'd ever had, evidently. And so I got promoted as a busboy, had a guy there, a local named Peter Yarrow, who famously was Peter from Peter, Paul, and Mary. He really liked me as a busboy, and he requested that they promote me to waiter. So they let me wait on Peter when he was in, and then I was busboy other than that for about a month. And again, did such a good job, always early, stayed late, never complained, started to work my way up. So within about a year, I was now the head waiter and the training waiter at the nicest restaurant in town, making six figures, making $1,000 a day cash sometimes, got certified as a sommelier, became an F&B director of a restaurant concept, got into management, and spent nearly the next 20 years, probably the next 16 years or so, working in restaurants. And in that capacity, some of that time is spent as an executive, a consultant, a manager. A lot of the time is spent on the floor, either as a bartender or a waiter. And I developed great people skills, and I was able to make a good living for quite some time. Then I ended up spending all of the savings that I was able to amass into starting my software company 4 years ago. I tried to start a wine website 2 years prior. It was kind of my first startup that was a swing and a miss, but it was also a learning experience. And one of the things that in retrospect I learned is you can't be a part-time entrepreneur. You kind of got to be all in and take it from there. But so flash forward, the year is 2020. I have 24 people working at Shedwell. We've been growing that company. You know, we continue to grow headcount, revenue, investment, valuation, and all that. So I serve as the chief visionary officer there, as well as the chairman of the board. I've got a startup kind of built around this weird cult following. And I don't call the people weird. It's just the following itself has become an entity and a life unto itself. But that's something that we're monetizing. We call that Corey Connects, which is the hashtag my network gave to me on LinkedIn. And I've taken my six-figure following and my millions of views there, and I've used to try to help people around the world. So at this point, we've helped a couple hundred people get either promoted or dream jobs. We've actually helped some people get off the streets and out of some very dangerous situations around the world. Helped a lot of people upskill, helped a lot of people kind of polish up their resumes. I'm getting a seal of approval from some of my security team.
Hey, listen, we all have to have the bosses. It's COVID time. We got to have the boss in the conversation as well.
Well, and then because I wasn't able to get all my directors and operators insurance and key man insurance and all that because of health, I now have to roll with security. So that's my security detail.
So let's go back. In 5 minutes or less, you've told an incredible story. Let's go back, because the amazing thing about people in the restaurant industry, you know, I've worked in the restaurant industry, I've worked in, you know, fine dining, I've worked some incredible things, is that those people who have initiative, those people who work hard, those people that are people, and people that are sitting there going, how can I help others succeed? You know, people within the industry take notice and they promote you. Customers tend to ask you for name. What brought you to that point where you sat there and said, okay, I'm going to go from being a busboy to, wait a second, what's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? What were the thought processes that were going through your head that sat there and said, I can be more, I can do more, I can learn more, I can take myself to the next level? Because for that full year where you were living on the street, that can take a lot of toll out of you. That could take a lot of your ego out of you. That could take a lot of your self-confidence out of you. How did you get to that point where you sat there and said, okay, it's time to rebuild and it's time to move forward and it's time to sit there and say, what's next? And then go out and figure out how to do it.
I think I always had the drive. So even on the street, I was convinced I was either going to be the world's biggest drug dealer or the world's biggest rap or something like that. And so I was never complacent. I was never okay with having nothing. I think that in entrepreneurship, we talk about pivoting and being nimble. I think back then I really was just trying to find either the easy way or the way that logically worked as someone that was a college dropout that grew up listening to rap music and things like that. I think I was just really disillusioned. And, you know, it seemed like I'd seen this work in the movies. And I think at a certain point, it's humbling to wash dishes, but that's kind of what got me out of my situation almost inadvertently. I mean, it was not a deliberate strategy at all. I didn't have the foresight to try to pick myself up off the ground. And the way that I would do that is an entry-level job. I mean, I just kind of fell into you've got a roof over your head for a very low amount of money. But I think I got fortunate to be in a ski town away from anywhere where there are people living in 20,000 square foot homes that sold all the drugs in town. There was no room for me to escalate in that world, right? It's kind of, you had to be humble. There are people like Oprah Winfrey and Tom Cruise that lived in this town of just a couple thousand. It's, you know, all eyes were on you. I was the new guy. I was told in very certain terms, don't screw this up. That's a town that people famously never heard from again if you don't kind of get accepted into that ecosystem. And so I knew that it was kind of an opportunity. And frankly, I was very, very fortunate at that time. I had some locals that absolutely took to my personality. I'm a recording artist and a performer and always have been. So they let me to start perform with the artists when they came through town. And a lot of the artists that come through that town are quite famous. You get like a Bob Dylan and James Brown and all that. It was a great opportunity. My life would have never been the same had I not been taken there. And I'm a big proponent of everything happens for a reason. I think I was on the streets prior to that for a reason. And similarly, I think I was brought to that little mountain town for a reason.
Yeah, I'm a big believer too. It's just that adversity is only adversity if we don't learn from it. We have the ability, each and every single one of us, to either sit there and go, oh my God, my life is terrible. Everybody's doing something against me. It's somebody else's fault. Or we can sit there and say, you know what? This is the situation. This is where I want to go. What am I missing to get to where I need to go? All right, let's build the relationships. Let's see what I need to learn. Let's figure it out to be able to move forward. So what I want to talk about is, let's talk about Shedwell. Let's talk about how did you figure that out? Because after 15, 16 years in the restaurant industry, what were you seeing? What was the pain point that you were seeing? What was the frustration that you were seeing that led you to that aha moment? Because that's how businesses are built. Businesses are built because people sit there and go, wait a second here, there's a problem. How can I fix it? So what was the major problem that you were seeing out there that nobody else was figuring out?
I'm going to take it one step deeper to get to that question. So the first thing is, I finally reached a point in my 30s where I couldn't wait tables anymore. I had regulars like Steve Harvey and Kevin Hart, Michael Jordan. I had Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones when he was in town, Vince Vaughn, who is an actor I grew up respecting. Anytime the Bears, any of the local teams would come in, I was their waiter. I had Vice President Joe Biden, former President Bill Clinton. These became people that I'd wait on somewhat regularly. And although they were all very nice to me, at least all the ones I mentioned, I didn't mention those that weren't, but they were all very nice to me. They all made it incredibly apparent that I was a servant in the castle. I wasn't one of them. They didn't respect me as a human being. And it wasn't intentional. They all have hearts of gold. It's very difficult at a certain station in life to respect the people that you perceive as making very low wages being your servant, right? And I started to tune into that. Now, my great aunt married the crown king of England. He became the Duke of Windsor just to marry her. My grandfather amassed a fortune he was the guy that came up with the ideas of the end caps for grocery stores. I didn't grow up wealthy on the one hand, but I always had seen and been tangential to the fact that people can succeed and you can make it on your own. And so to feel like a servant, even though in a nice car, a nice place to live, a nice looking, you know, wife and all of that. However, that bug was planted a couple of years before I finally waited my last table, and just understanding that putting on a $300-$400 outfit and taking a $50 Uber and walking out with $1,000 in cash, and you're still just a king in the, or a servant in the castle, right? It wasn't just humbling. It started to really grind at me. And so with that, through that lens, I didn't want to be a servant anymore. I was starting to actively try to figure out, I knew I didn't want to go back to college in my late 30s. I didn't feel like I needed an MBA. I felt as though I had some competencies. But what I had more than anything is I had at that point on and off been working about 70 to 80 hours a week and two jobs full-time to provide for elements of my life and people in my life and things like that. And so I had the work ethic, I had the passion. So that brings us to the problem that I then saw, because I knew that I needed to solve a problem. Well, scheduling in the restaurant industry is a big problem. Half the call shifts are on call, and you don't know until the day of if you're going to work or not. And they tell you last minute they don't need you. You can't plan your life around that. A lot of my friends that had children couldn't plan childcare around that. Most childcare traditionally ends at 6 p.m. And so the scheduling, I said, wait a minute, no one's using data to really help drive some of these scheduling decisions. And so that's when I decided to come out with what we consider to be a smart shift scheduling platform. And today, Shedule uses machine learning and artificial intelligence and algorithmic rules-based scheduling to help companies stay compliant and to help them with their EBITDA and to return additional labor percentage points. And so through that lens, I started to put together the team and I learned some SEO and I learned some digital marketing and I learned some graphics design. I learned that I'm not smart enough to code.
Welcome to the crowd.
I'm back on Coursera. Now I feel like, you know, maybe I'll learn a couple of these hybrid languages now that I feel as though I know enough to be dangerous. I'm ready to see if now is the time that I can actually learn to program. But 4 years ago, it was glaringly obvious that I knew a lot more about wine than I knew about computer architecture, computer sciences. And so I put together a team. I learned to delegate. I read some great books. I didn't take no for an answer. The 98% of people in my life that said there's no way you can start an app or a business. And so nothing about apps and you know nothing about business. You know, I'm very grateful I didn't give any credence to anything any of them had to say. And I've been fortunate to be blessed with just nothing but dumb luck along my journey. So not everything I've done has been lucky. I've learned a lot of hard lessons, but everything I've needed to happen has happened. And whenever we need a certain talent or a certain amount of money or we need to close a certain deal, they typically end up happening in our benefit. And when they don't, we learn from them. So it's been a journey, 4 years now with Shedule.
I love the comment. And people say this to me, it is, you don't know what you don't know. It's amazing how we do things and we're successful despite, because there's lots of things. People say, oh, you can't do it. And they're thinking, well, he can't do it because he doesn't know this or he doesn't know this, but they don't articulate it. They just say, well, he can't do it. And a lot of it of our success comes from the fact that we don't know what we don't know. But a lot of unsuccessful entrepreneurs try to do everything. You are smart enough to realize, okay, I have talents. I have things I'm not talented at. I'm going to build a team. Does that come directly from the team mentality of the restaurant industry, where my memories of the restaurant industry is you can't survive alone. If you're a great waiter, you can't survive without a great busboy. You can't somebody at the front making sure the tables are set, making sure the tables are cleared, the kitchen, the wine room, everything. It's bringing that whole team together and realizing that everybody has their skill. Was that a real asset for you? And how did you take that and move that into building your own business? Like, how did you take that thought process and move it forward?
Yeah, so I've never really connected those dots in that capacity, but I think you're absolutely right. And when I was at the Prime Steakhouse, I helped open and worked until I waited my last table. It was everything from the food runner and the expediter to, even though I was integral with the wine program, I had a wine runner that was bringing me the $1,000 bottles of vintage Bordeaux to certain tables in certain sections so that I could be present to take the next order for the $150 Kobe steak. And right, it's not only the right people doing the right things, but you trusting the process. So I didn't need to worry if my bottle of Chateauneuf du Pape was going to come to POS station by table 200 while I was overtaking this order for lobster mash potatoes. I'd take the order because I knew when I was done, I'd turn around, the bottle of wine was there. And I think with entrepreneurship as well, I'm not going to look over the shoulders of my tech team. Frank, I wouldn't know what I was looking at, right? I give them, or at this point, my PM and my team, but we give specs and we assume that on this date, this product will be released for testing or whatever it might be. And so it's, yeah, I do think my team, a lot of the people in my orbit at this point do notice and make mention of the fact that I do just seem to trust the process. And I think that must come from waiting tables and having that team firing on all cylinders.
Trust is huge. You're no longer the CEO. You're the chief visionary officer. As you were building the company, sitting there going, okay, this is our vision. This is what we're trying to do. This is the goal that we have in mind. And bringing the right people on board and say, you have the talent to do this. This is what I need to get done. You figure out how to get it done on time and right. And not sitting there and micromanage. And that's the problem. There's too many companies out there that hire micromanagers. And it frustrates people and it leads to process being broken down. So how do you make sure that your people know this is the vision, this is what we're expecting, this is what we're trying to do, letting them go out and have their individual genius and let them bring that genius to the table.
Yeah, I say this jokingly and knowing that I have a team that listens to everything I record. But so I will say that I'm kidding when I say that I accomplish that by yelling. But sometimes I think it's a matter of articulating and then re-articulating. I'm an empath. I really do try and look at anything and everything I do say or portray is how it's going to be received. So it's culture comes from the top down. If I say something, it's my opportunity and my obligation to make sure that people understand it. And so I think through that lens, it's always knowing the right questions to ask and when. You trust people to a degree, but you also make sure that you're setting them up for success. And I think that's, my team hears me say often and probably to every single person as an individual, that I'm there to set them up for success. And if I do that and they don't succeed, ultimately that it's on me, but they will be gone and I'll take that as a learning experience. And I don't like to fire people. I don't like any of that. And so when I say I set them up to succeed, it's almost selfishly so that I don't have to go and do anything difficult. But also, you know, I'm big on saying that hard and together we rise. And I think that's the mentality I bring to my team as well. Is the only way we're going to really succeed is if we all do deliver upon what's expected of us, go above and beyond, do it for all the right reasons, and, you know, give each other that opportunity and that freedom to fail, because those failures add up to our successes. So that's one of the biggest things. People on my team, probably 90%, I'd love to think it was 100%, but probably very close to 100% are not afraid to fail. And I just admit it. Let's figure out how we can learn from those. I celebrate failures personally, and I hope they do the same. But to your point, everybody processes things a bit differently. And so it's, what I can't do is tell everyone that just because I can smile when I lose, that they need to do the same. And so that's, I found that being an executive is more like being a babysitter than anything else as well. So it's understanding how different people respond to different situations and kind of meeting them where they're at.
Being a leader is a challenging thing because it's about inspiration, it's about communication, it's about allowing people to do things their own way. But how do you go ahead and teach people how to be leaders themselves? Because the way to be, how to grow a company, is for great leaders to create the next generation and allow them to create the next generation of leaders. So how do you go and make sure that the people that work for you have a leadership mentality and that they are set up to not only succeed on their own, but to help other people succeed in the company?
So with Shedwell, I kind of cheated. I brought on, my CTO's got 6 exits and is one of the guys to help create the smartphone. He's got 120 patents. I brought in a guy to support him as our product manager that was the CTO of Princeton Review when they went public. My CEO was the director of technology for McDonald's US for many years. My director of Marcom built a multi-million-dollar company in the event space. And so, you know, I think I got very lucky, and I basically brought in global leaders in their spaces that represented the skill sets and the reputation that I needed. Now, I don't say that lightly. I'm not being cavalier. And I know not everybody can just go out and get global leaders. I don't know that I could do it again if I tried. And it's not something I think anybody should aspire to. I got very fortunate. And some of that is years into a venture, I figured out who the right people might be and figured out ways, you know, and some of it's using LinkedIn even, but to get on their radars and to earn their respect and things of that nature. But what I would say more generally is the way that I would anticipate, especially with some of my new ventures, is setting people up for leaders, is to kind of come in, lead by light examples, right? Just incidents and one-offs where they can see me come in. I say something needs to get done and I do it, and then leave them with the opportunity to rinse, wash, and repeat, right? I don't want to have to come in and do something twice. If so, I didn't teach it right the first time. And what I'll then do is I'll make sure that I have people in the process that I can then entrust. For me, it's all about empowerment and entrusting. So that third time, it won't be me. And if I've got people that didn't understand it, I've got people that do that can teach them. And to me, that's scalable. I can be off teaching a new skill to a new subset of employees or prospects, or running a demo or writing a book or learning how to surf or whatever it is I'm doing that week.
Well, if you need a great surf teacher, I got one in Australia that he's actually an Australian champion. So if you ever need that connection, Scotty, that's you. You're happy to make those connections for you. So if you have
what's Scotty's last name?
Schindler.
Yep, I know Scott.
Amazing guy, amazing surfer. He was a great guest on this show.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've spent some time chatting and I like him a lot. I've got family in Hawaii that lives with and spends some time with Jack Johnson, the musician, but he's also the editor-in-chief of Surf Style magazine. And he spent about 9 months on Sir Richard Branson's yacht with him and took some epic pictures of Richard Branson surfing. And so those guys have always told me they'd give me a lesson. But I think get down to Australia and spending some time with Scotty might be even better, because he'll take the time to make sure I actually understand it. I won't be just having to try to keep up. I played my first round of golf 2 weeks ago up in Door County, Wisconsin. Played 18 holes with a former PGA guy. And when he's talking about some of the guys on the tour, he calls them by first names. He's talking about Phil and Jack and Tiger did this. And we're on the course, and of course he was much better than me, but I learned so much just watching him, and I had the best time ever. So now I feel like that's going to be me with surfing. Next thing you know, I'm going to be a surfing, golfing ex-CEO and loving every minute of it.
Doesn't sound so terrible. Anytime you want to pick up the sticks, give me a call. Always happy to play. So let's switch gears a little bit, because before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about Corey Connects. I think that's really important. I mean, to me, it's Corey Cares, because Corey is connecting. I want to find out a little bit more about what was the thought process that brought that together, and what are you trying to achieve with that? Because it's really, as you said, it's elevating, it's raising the water for everybody. And I want to hear more from you and just say, where do you want to take that, and how do you want that? What's your vision for that expanding?
Yeah, I'll bring some news here on your show then. And this is, we will be, and for me, I'll give most of it away. It's not about a dollar amount, but we'll be a multi-billion dollar company. And effectively, what I've done for the last 3 years since I started to be active on LinkedIn is learn how, on a very scientific level, how to grow on LinkedIn. So I A/B test the algorithm. I find out the little things. And sometimes it's a space at the beginning of a second line. If you post on mobile, make a post do a little bit better. Sometimes it used to be a certain amount of hashtags in a certain order, right? In a certain placement, and all those little things. And so I've always, every time I figure something out, I do content around it and teach people freely. And people come to me and want me to help them revamp their profile, want me to help teach them how to use content. And the last year when I was bootstrapping Shedwell, people came to me in such numbers wanting me to teach them that I started doing some paid coaching and some paid masterminding. And I was able to actually hire some people and pay some people to help with Shedwell with the money I was making off of my LinkedIn coaching. And so it's been this somewhat natural progression. But and then I say this lovingly to my Shedwell team, but I had an opportunity at the very beginning of COVID where some very competent college students had been offered paid internships, and then COVID happened and these companies said no. Budget was gone, the opportunity was gone, they didn't have the time, the resources, the capacity, they weren't going to pay college kids money to come in and learn. And so a guy came to me and he said, Corey, I know you love to help people, I know you've got a company, I've got some interns that I think would be amazing. I don't expect you to pay them. They no longer expect to be paid for an internship, but now they've got nothing but time. They could probably learn a lot from you, and we know you've got a heart. So these other companies are saying no. We're hoping that you'll say yes and that you'll bring these kids under your wing. And I said, I'm very happy to do that. And I made the introduction to my executive team. God bless them. They said the same thing all these other companies said, we don't have the time. You know, and it was very disheartening. They basically said no to free labor. Now, three of these kids are programmers, full stack developers. One of them has done some projects for the government and for the biggest tech company in the world, been paid quite a bit. And I couldn't understand where the disconnect was. But what I wasn't going to do is say, well, then I wasn't going to help them. So okay, Shedwell wasn't going to help them. I brought them in anyway. And I said, listen, it's not going to be for Shedwell. And I don't want to put you all through a situation where you're going to have my executive team want you to fill out all these paperwork and give you this hard time and give you all these lines in the sand. And, you know, we're just not going to do that. So I will bring you under my wing and I will let you help grow my personal brand. And you will be able to not only put that in your portfolio, and I will help you out as though I'm your coach and you won't pay me anything. I will teach you really in a true apprenticeship fashion. I said, but I think what we've got here is an opportunity to make some money. And so we'll do an even profit share. Basically, anything we can bring in, you make what I make, and we're going to become a family, and I'm going to empower you guys. And so very quickly, what we understood is I talked to a buddy of mine in Pittsburgh, and he's got a video game company, and they've won Game of the Year at PAX, which is the big video game conference. They've got exclusive license to remake cartridges for Nintendo and Sega and all these things. And they're doing the video game right now for Mike Tyson and for Popeye. And my buddy is the CEO of this company. And I told him that I was bringing on some really smart tech interns to help with my personal brand. He said, Corey, you should have a video game. And I said, well, I don't disagree with you. And he said, you come up with an idea and we'll get started on it. So I went back to my team, and then we had what I think is going to end up being a world-changing idea. And it's in development right now. We're putting together a chat box. And I stood corrected. I thought it was chat bot. It's not. It's a chat box. And our chat box looks like me, and it acts like me, and it winks and it talks. And it's the Corey Connects chat box. Well, listen to this. This will blow your mind. What this does in real time is what Grammarly does for grammar, but it does it for social media. So now when you're using LinkedIn as a user, it will do everything that I've ever taught anybody in real time using automation completely for free. So as you're writing a post, it'll say, hey, don't do hashtag business goals. It's got no followers. It's going to confuse the algorithm. Or do hashtag business, hashtag goals, put it at the end of the post. It's going to reach 10 times the amount of feed. Or you hit post and it says, no, we recommend you wait 2 hours because 20 other people in your geographic location just hit post. This is going to get lost in the feed. And then you can bypass any of these things just like in Grammarly. You can misspell something. You just say ignore it. It's going to ignore it. You can do that in this bot as well, but it's giving you real-time suggestions. But you can use this bot as a recruiter, a job seeker, or an influencer, and it gives you different tips and tricks. So now, if you're a job seeker, it's going to say, hey, here's a template of a post you should post. Insert your skills, who you want to work with here. By the way, these are 3 recruiters online in your industry that are on the platform right now, actively engaging with posts. Tag them. It's amazing because what it's going to do is it's going to give millions of people opportunities to grow, get more followers, more engagement, get more targeted, but also to get jobs, to upskill.
More targeted customers, more targeted connections. It's going to be get your stuff in the eyes of people that actually care about it.
In the right format so that it can be indexed, so that it gets that visibility, so that people can 10x their views, 10x their followers, 10x their efficacy. You can use it as a salesperson to get more targeted leads, get them qualified, start the conversation. We have partners that automate that conversation. And so where we're going, where that becomes very important. And again, it's free. We have ways to monetize that. And we believe that Microsoft and LinkedIn will buy that as a standalone product because it keeps people spending more time on platform and generates the right data. But we're actually the video game that we're building, the Corey Connects video game, takes that into a virtual world. You play the game as a job seeker, recruiter, or an influencer. In the game, you're walking around what we're calling Corey Land. It's like Disneyland. There are different worlds. You've got resume. Yeah.
I want to ride the roller coaster.
Yeah, well, people are saying, and that's really how it is. But in the game, you do things like go on and build up your profile, your resume and CV, and then we help optimize it for ATS or for first impression. You go on and you can actually, as a job seeker, your avatar will go, you find the recruiter and you interview with this. And afterwards, you use the data points. Here's how you could have done better. When you were asked these 3 questions, you should have said this based on your history. Why didn't you mention this? They were looking for this. You didn't say it. So you get all these bullet points on how to interview back, but the recruiter avatar gets the same thing. Hey, this person had 2 years of experience. You had 5 years minimum requirement. You wasted your time. They only have a bachelor's. You required a master's. Things like that. But also, when you ask them if they had any other questions and they said no, you could have pressed by saying this. So everyone walks away a little smarter, but here's where the magic happens. That could have been 2 real people. And after every bit of data is analyzed and given back to them, they will be asked if that was a real person on the other end. Would you want to facilitate a real second interview? So we're now gamifying recruiting. We're sitting at that intersection.
So if it could be a real person, if they said, would you be interested? All of a sudden, you'll connect with that actual person, if it's a real person.
And a double opt-in, yeah. And so it takes all the friction out. You engage with it. Yeah, it's so much fun. And so we're getting some IP around a lot of that. We've got companies looking to put some big money into the game right now that want in-game placement. So the job seeker is going to interview many times a day. You'll need more energy, right? So does Starbucks want them to have to go find a latte? Does Rockstar want them to have to go find an energy drink? We're actually talking to a functional beverage company about being the energy up in the game. But same thing for recruiters. Who's going to be the in-game recruiting house? Who's going to be, right? If you're in one land and you need to get to another, maybe you have credits or you need to take a Lyft or an Uber, right? Or maybe Via gets in. So we've got so many fun ways, to monetize this thing. My team are brilliant. I hired a team of 9 to help with that initiative. And then we've got an extension that's a sales arm, an extension that's our PR arm, and we're having a lot of fun.
That's awesome. You know, I could sit here and talk to you all day, but I want to ask you one last question before you go. And we'll put all of your contact information in the show notes so people can get in touch with you. But here's something that's going to really tell the tale. When you leave a meeting and you drive away, what's the one thing you want people to think about you when you're not in the room?
So that's a great question. And it's going to be, pun is intended, and you'll know why it's a pun, but the answer is going to be weird. And here's why. What people say about me when I leave a room right now, I know what they say, and it's what I already want them to say. And it wasn't calculated, but it's now something that I'm okay with moving forward. And when I leave that party, when I leave that boardroom, when I leave that whatever it is, people are saying, wow, he is weird. And I like that. I'm perfectly fine with that because what they mean by that he is weird is he's got so much energy. I'm not used to seeing that. He's so ambitious. Ben, I'll tell you, I've got ideas right now, and I talk to engineers at some of the international agencies. I've got an idea right now using physics and 3D printing to get to the bottom of the ocean. If that works, I think we can use it to get to the moon. That's the type of thing I'm involved with right now. I believe I've identified a way to make very small sustainable batteries that'll always have a charge that are ecologically friendly. I study things like ways to turn plastic in the ocean into edible food and to break it down. And so if people don't think I'm weird, then they either weren't listening or I wasn't allowed to talk enough, right? I don't need people to think I'm a genius. I've been told that many times, and I love the quote, that ridicule is a burn of genius. I'm okay with that. I've got my share of haters in Chicago, the US, and around the world on LinkedIn. I have nothing but love for my haters. I don't need everybody to like me. So I'm not there to impress. I'm not there to play. Kate, I'm a good listener as well. And so I don't need to be the only one talking. But I think once people meet me and I leave, if they're not alone just thinking that I was weird, they're actively saying it. And I'm perfectly fine with that.
Corey, I love this conversation. I love your passion. I love your insight. You think big. You take a look and you sit there and say, what if? Not to say, why not? And it's a beautiful thing. And I love people that are looking towards the future, that are sitting there going, you know what? What could be? Because we don't have all the answers. We haven't asked all the questions. I love people that are thinking big. So thank you for being on the show. And thanks for your passion.
You're welcome. I want to say one last thing as it pertains to you and anyone listening. I have personally read your book, Ben, and it's amazing. And so I want to thank you for your book. It touches some things in my life that are a big part of my life and some things that I've chosen to not pursue as much. However, the way you articulate it, the book's fun. I've actually shared it with some people through the Corey Connects channel as well, and the feedback's been great. So not for nothing, but I'm a fan not only of your show, but your book and of you and yours as well. So thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
I appreciate that. Powerful Personal Brands was a great book to write, and I love that it touched you. I really appreciate that.
This has been the YourLivingBrand.live show. I want to thank you for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show at YourLivingBrand.live and share your favorite episodes with colleagues and friends. At Your Brand Marketing, we help companies engage, retain, and grow their most valuable assets, their employees. If you're tired of losing great staff and want to retain your best employees, build brand champions and leaders at any level. Contact us for a 30-minute consultation at yourbrandmarketing.com. That's www.yourbrandmarketing.com. Thank you again for listening and sharing. Tune in next week when we ask another guest, what's your story?